Hi, welcome back. I am so sorry for all the technical difficulties, revving audio and video and lots of issues. But thank you guys for your patience and resilience in joining back on. I'm going to start from the top. I wrote Chasing My Cure because I learned so much about life and about living from nearly dying five times, lessons that I wanted to share with the world. And so tonight I'm going to share some of those lessons with you. And then I'm also going to share about my transition from going from fighting to survive to fighting to identify a drug that could save my life to now searching for other diseases and searching for solutions for other diseases so we can save many, many more lives. So I thought I'd start out my talk by taking us back to when I first started chasing after my cure. This is a picture of me as a healthy third-year medical student at the University of Pennsylvania, where I was training to become an oncologist in memory of my mom, who had passed away just a few years before. This is a picture of my mom and I, just a few months after her brain surgery. She was diagnosed with brain cancer and battled the most incredibly brave battle against cancer for 15 months. Unfortunately, she passed away in 2004, and I was just completely devastated to lose her at that age, and we missed her so much. From that, I made this promise to her and that I would dedicate my life to becoming a cancer doctor to treat patients just like her. So a few years later, I was at Penn training to become an oncologist when out of nowhere, I began experiencing multi-organ system failure. My liver, my kidneys, my bone marrow, my heart, and my lungs all began to shut down for no known cause. You can see photographed here me where I'd gained 70 pounds of fluid. A retinal hemorrhage made me blind in my left eye. I went in and out of consciousness, all due to a cytokine storm. You guys have probably heard cytokine storm a lot in the media lately. COVID-19 can cause a Castleman's-like cytokine storm. And so this picture here was me going through multi-organ failure. I was so sick that I actually had a priest come in and administer my last rites to me because the doctors didn't think I would survive. I've really considered that moment to be the start of my overtime. Overtime being time that I didn't think that I would have, but where every second really has to count. So, throughout the talk today, I'm going to share a few lessons that I think are really, really important. And this first one is that we are all in overtime. Because I've had my last rites read to me, I can hear the clock ticking. But the reality is that we are all in this scenario where we don't know how much time we have, and we have to make the most of every second. So one quote that I wanted to read: the experience of being in overtime is surprisingly one of intense awareness and scrutiny and clarity. There's a reason for that. When there are only a few seconds left on the board, all distractions disappear, and the purpose, victory, becomes clear. The present is only the things around you, and overtime is all present, nothing but present and purpose. Many of us in the midst of COVID-19 are feeling this sense of overtime, maybe in ways that we have not felt before. We realize that at any moment, COVID-19 could affect us or someone that we love. And so we're recognizing that we do need to make the most of our time. And sometimes the fear and the of uncertainty can actually create a sense of calm that we can say, we know what's important. I'm going to spend the time doing the things that are most important to me. And in many ways, being in overtime and not knowing how much time I have left has been really liberating for me. I also know a bit about overtime because I played college football at Georgetown and spent some time in overtimes, and certainly understand that in overtime, every decision, every action is so important because you don't know how much time you have. And I've really taken that experience and those learnings to apply to other aspects of my life. Another really important thing happened to me when I was at Georgetown, and that's that I met my girlfriend, Caitlin. Caitlin and I started dating while I was in college, and we dated for the next couple of years while I went to grad school in England, and then when I was in medical school here at Penn. And then just a few months before I became ill, Caitlin and I decided to take a break. And at the time, we thought to ourselves, we're only 25 years old. We've got all the time in the world. If it's meant to be, it'll work out. And then there I was, just a few months later, dying in the intensive care unit, having my last rites read to me and realizing that I had run out of time, that there was no more time left. So with that, I realized that I could not take any actions, or that I needed to make sure that if I wanted to do something, I couldn't just wait and hope that something would work out in the future, that if it was something that I cared about, I needed to think it and then do it. And so the next lesson I wanted to highlight is this concept of think it, do it. It came from the simple realization that the regrets that aided me the most as I prepared to die weren't about anything I'd done. My greatest regrets were things that I had thought of doing but never did. It's the absence of memories that you wish you had made and the realization that you'll never get the chance to make them that was so difficult for me. So as I laid in that hospital bed, I wished and I hoped that Caitlin and I could be together. I wished and hoped that I had spent those last few months with her before I was then going to pass. And I wished that I could maybe one day have been able to have a family with Caitlin. And when I got through this, and as I've gotten through this, I've realized that I needed to do anything in my power to make sure that if I think about doing something, that I take action and turn it into actually doing. But right around the time I had my last rites read to me, I was finally diagnosed with idiopathic multicentric Castleman disease, a rare and deadly immune system disorder where your immune system attacks and shuts down your body's vital organs. It actually acts in many ways like COVID-19 acts, where patients get very, very sick with multi-organ failure. Unfortunately, a third of us will die within 5 years of diagnosis, and another third will die within 10 years of diagnosis. It's a rare disease. About 5,000 patients are diagnosed each year in the U.S., and unfortunately, it affects individuals of all ages. With this diagnosis, I was begun on chemotherapy, and thankfully, I got chemotherapy just in time because it saved my life. Unfortunately, I would go on to have a number of additional relapses and require additional combinations of chemotherapy. So this is a picture of my dad and I, now about 5 months into my battle. You can see that I've lost my hair due to the chemotherapy, but you can see I'm just so happy to be alive and just so thankful that the chemo has saved me. And of course, thankful to have my dad's support throughout. Here's another picture from just a few days later, now New Year's Eve, December 31st of 2010, when my dad and I decided to go for a walk around the hematology oncology floor. As you can see, I have a giant belly from all the fluid that I had gained because my liver and my kidneys weren't working, but I was just so glad to be alive. So my dad and I took a walk around the floor, and as we passed the family waiting area, we noticed that there was a gentleman who looked like he'd been drinking on New Year's Eve. And on our next lap around the floor, we saw that this gentleman had fallen onto the ground. So my dad ran over to him and helped him back into his chair. He looked at my dad and I, and he said, "Thanks so much. Good luck to you and your wife." I said, "Wife, what is he talking about?" And then I looked down at my belly and I realized he thought that I was my dad's pregnant wife, which was a low point emotionally for both of us. But we just burst into laughter. And I turned to my dad and I said, "Man, you've got an ugly wife." And we just continued to laugh. And as I think about that experience and think about so many challenges I faced, I think I've learned just how powerful humor can be. For those of us that are, really all of us that are struggling right now with COVID-19, I think we can appreciate how helpful humor and internet memes can be during these really, really scary times. An excerpt that I wanted to read here is, "Facing my horrible moments with laughter was just as fundamentally a rejection of Castleman's dominion over me as anything else I was doing. It cleared my mind. It stiffened my resolve. It was entirely up to me to determine what was and what wasn't funny. Perhaps most important, humor is social. For me and my family, there was never a better way to reset our collective resolve than laughing together." And I think that's exactly what we need right now. So many of us to laugh together in the midst of a really, really scary time. Here's a picture of me when I got out of the hospital, and you can really appreciate how someone may have confused me as a pregnant woman. I've got a really, really big belly from the liver and kidney failure. Now, this is a picture from just a few years before when I played college football. And I always say this is the worst before and after picture of all time. But if we could flip the order and we could have it from right to left, I think it could be a great advertisement for Peloton or for Muscle Milk or for any one of those workout supplements. But actually, I did not use any of those supplements or use a Peloton. This was purely getting my disease into remission. I took a picture every week for the next 8 weeks. You can see the fluid going away. You can see my hair starting to grow back. And I look a little bit less like a pregnant woman by the end. One of the first things I did when I got out of the hospital was to reconnect with Caitlin and to let her know that I didn't want to just wait and hope to see if our relationship could work out, but to really to try to make this relationship work and to put in the effort and energy that it needed. Around the same time, I also got started on an experimental drug called ciltuximab that I hoped would keep my disease in remission, the only drug that had ever undergone a randomized controlled trial for my disease, and I was so hopeful that it would work for me. This is a picture of Caitlin and I a few months later. You can see on one of my shoulders, I've got my treatment infusing into me, and the other shoulder, I've got Caitlin that I'm leaning on. I think this is a really fitting picture for the support that she provided me through some really, really tough times. So back at Penn, I got involved in Penn's Orphan Disease Center, which was working to advance research for rare diseases. And then about a year after I got out of the hospital, I had a full-blown relapse. You can see from this photo that I lost all of my hair and I needed multi-agent chemotherapy again to try to save my life. And as I was in the hospital, I turned to my dad, my sisters, and to Caitlin, and I promised them that I would dedicate the rest of my life to trying to identify a treatment and a cure for this disease. I had just learned that there were no more drugs in development, that there were no more promising leads. And I realized that if I didn't do it, that no one would. And so I started by conducting research at Penn in a lab here, and also starting a foundation called the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network to accelerate research and treatment for Castleman disease on an international scale. And this really leads to lesson number four, and that's to turn hope into action. Hope cannot be a passive concept. It's a choice and a force. Hoping for something takes more than casting out a wish to the universe and waiting for it to occur. Hope should inspire action. And when it does inspire action in medicine and science, that hope can become a reality beyond your wildest dreams. So where were we back in 2012? The first step would be, let's get an understanding for where we were, and then we could figure out what to do moving forward. Well, about $10,000 were being invested each year into research into idiopathic multicentric Castleman disease. No NIH dollars were going towards IMCD research. No patients were in a contact registry because there wasn't a contact registry. There were two advocacy organizations around, but there was no research infrastructure, collaboration, or plan for how to push forward the science. There were no diagnostic criteria. There were drugs being used, like the chemotherapies I mentioned, but there were no predictive biomarkers of who was likely to respond versus not respond. There were no cell lines, animal models, registries, or biobanks. There were no treatment guidelines in place. The disease was very poorly understood. There were no FDA-approved drugs, and there was one drug in development, the drug that I mentioned, ciltuximab, that unfortunately I relapsed while on that drug. But thankfully, there was reason to be hopeful, and there was good reason to be positive, and that's because this incredible doctor, Kazuo Yoshizaki, he was the one who identified interleukin-6 as being elevated in a large number of Castleman's patients, and he wanted to develop a drug that targets the receptor for interleukin-6, this really important cytokine or inflammatory molecule that was elevated in the blood of Castleman's patients. And I'd been told by one of Kazu's colleagues that Kazu actually gave the drug to himself to be the first human to get it to prove that it was safe. And when I went to Kazu, I said, Kazu, Makoto told me that you gave tocilizumab to yourself as the first human to prove it was safe. And he said, no, I didn't give it to myself. The nurse, she gave it to me. I said, okay, Kazu, that's exactly what I meant. Well, thankfully, Kazu did okay on that drug, and thankfully the drug went on to get approved for Castleman's in Japan. It also went on to get approved for rheumatoid arthritis here in the U.S., and there was a really important story and event when the first patient to ever be treated with chimeric antigen receptor therapy or CART therapy the first pediatric patient here in Philadelphia. She was very sick with one of these Castleman-like cytokine storms. And the doctors here at Penn treated her with tocilizumab, and it actually saved her life. This is a picture of Emily. Her life was saved thanks to this drug tocilizumab that Kazu had initially developed and even gave to himself to prove that it was safe. More recently, there have been more experiences that show the importance of rare disease development and drug development. And that's where this drug tocilizumab has now been used across the world to treat really sick coronavirus patients. This top article from the LA Times and from the New York Times, and then a newspaper in Boston, all reporting use of tocilizumab, this drug initially developed for Castleman disease by Kazu, tested on himself as the first human, is now helping coronavirus patients all over the world that are battling this Castleman's-like syndrome. So when I got out of the hospital and I realized where we were back in 2012, I decided that we would take a new approach to research. And I just knew that I couldn't do it on my own. I knew I would need to assemble an army. And so these are some photos of some of our team members, grad students, med students, colleagues of mine who decided to get to be a part of this Castleman's fight and to get involved in the Castleman's fight. And of course, we needed to do it with patients. And so one of the first things we did was hold a webinar where we invited patients from all over the world to join us. And this is the first image that I showed my fellow patients. And this is a castle man. And I proposed to them, I said, what do you guys think about this being our new logo for the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network? And they weren't particularly impressed. And so we went back to the drawing board, and this became our new Castleman, which we shared with our community, and they loved. And 2 weeks later, one of our patients posted this picture onto one of our social media pages. And this is a tattoo of the Castleman on his shoulder. And I always say, if this is not patient engagement, then I don't know what patient engagement is. But it really does show that our Castleman's patients were ready to get behind something, and we were so thrilled that they could get behind and be a part of this fight. So from connecting this incredible network of people, connecting our patient community, we then went to the physician and researcher community to identify and prioritize what research is most important. So we crowdsourced the most important research ideas. We went out and we raised money for specific projects. And throughout this whole process, we always looked to see what drugs are already FDA approved that could potentially help Castleman disease patients right away. And so you can see here, this is our research pipeline where we list out all of our studies that are in process or completed or in development. And you can see that there are over 20 different studies at various stages, all research studies that came to be based on our work and that would not have happened if not for this amazing team of people working together. So in the midst of this effort to build the CDCN, I graduated from medical school. This is a picture of Caitlin and I on my graduation day. We got engaged shortly thereafter, and were so hopeful that the drug that I was on, the multiple chemotherapies I was on, would help to keep me in remission so I could make it to our wedding day. But unfortunately, a few months after graduating from medical school, I had another relapse. For the fifth time, I was in the hospital, and for the fifth time, I spent weeks in critical condition, unsure if I would make it. Thankfully, chemotherapy saved my life. And this picture of Caitlin and I is from our engagement party when we were hoping so badly that I could make it, we could make it to our wedding date, but realizing that there was no way that I would if I didn't identify some sort of treatment that could help to keep me alive. And so I went back to all of the data that I'd been generating in the lab and tried to pull everything together that I could to identify something that might be able to help me. Just to give you guys a kind of a framework for what we were thinking, we knew the immune system was getting hyperactivated. We knew that there were signaling pathways within these immune cells that were dysregulated. We knew that there were cytokines and inflammatory markers that were elevated, but we didn't know why. And we didn't know which of these cells and cytokines are really the problem. So from the experiments that we ran, we were able to identify that VEGF, or vascular endothelial growth factor, this one particular cytokine, was very elevated. We also found that a particular type of immune cell called the T cell was also highly activated. And so we wondered, from the data that we generated on my samples, is there something that could maybe be connecting the two? Is there something involved in T-cell activation and also in VEGF expression. And so we went back to the data, and we found that there was a potential link. It's called the mTOR signaling pathway. mTOR is really important for cell proliferation. It's also really important for the immune system to get active. And so I ran a really important experiment. And on the top of the screen, you can see a picture of a normal lymph node. And in brown, brown is positive when there's mTOR activation, and blue is when there's no mTOR activation. You can see in a normal lymph node, there's some mTOR activation, but there's a lot of negative staining throughout the normal lymph node. And then you can see my lymph node, and you can appreciate right away that there is just a tremendous amount of mTOR activation in my tissue compared to what you see in a normal lymph node. So this told us that there maybe was a connection between the T cell activation and the VEGF, and maybe if we blocked the mTOR, which was involved in both of them, we could stop all three at once. It was kind of a way to say, if you can block mTOR, maybe you can hit all three birds with one stone. Thankfully, there's a drug that targets mTOR that was developed 30 years ago for kidney transplantation. It's called sirolimus. And based on our data, we decided to start treating me with sirolimus. So today marks 75.29 months since my last relapse. And I say 75.29 months because I know that I can't round up. I don't know if I'll make it to 76 months relapse free. But I also don't round down. And I refuse to round down because this incredible team and army that have been fighting me, we've worked so hard for every fraction of every month. The New York Times described this as Doctor Cure Thyself, which I think is a bit of an overstatement. I think it should probably be Doctor Helping Himself a little bit right now and hopefully for a lot longer. But really importantly, it enabled me and Caitlin to make it to our wedding day. This is us on our wedding day here in Philadelphia, and you can see my hair grew back just in time for our wedding day, which was actually pretty important. I wanted to not have the outward reminder of all the chemotherapy that I'd received and what our future could look like. And then really so important to us, 20 months ago, Caitlin and I had our sweet daughter, Amelia. And you can see her here. We named her Amelia Marie Fagenbaum. So she is the exact same three initials as my mom, Anne Marie Fagenbaum. She's our newest AMF, and she brings us so much joy. Over the last few years, we've also been thinking about other patients that this drug, sirolimus, could help. This is a picture of Joey, a patient here in Philadelphia who was very sick and didn't respond to first or second line therapy, but responded really well when sirolimus was added into the mix as third line therapy. This is him with his siblings. And then sweet Katie, another patient local to the Philadelphia area who really struggled with Castleman disease for many years and was eventually switched over to sirolimus and has been doing really, really well. Unfortunately, we've given this drug to a good number of patients, and it hasn't worked for everyone. These are a couple patients, Lisa and Sergio, who, despite first line and second line and third line therapy, and despite sirolimus, we were not able to control their disease. So we know that we still have so much work ahead of us. We're so thankful for the progress, but we know that somewhere around one third to one half of Castleman's patients are able to have their disease controlled based on the treatments available to us now. So these are just a few Castleman's patients from all over the world. And we know that about half of them can benefit from treatments that we have, but we know that we need to help the other half by continuing to push forward the science. So where are we today in 2020? Well, over the last 8 years, we've raised about $1.4 million for research, which has led to an additional $1.1 million in additional funding from external groups. So now it's over $11.5 million have gone towards Castleman's research, as opposed to previously what was about $10,000 a year. A significant increase, I guess about a thousandfold increase compared to what it was previously. The NIH gave its first grant ever to study Castleman disease research a couple of years ago. We now have over 1,200 patients in our registry. There used to be two different advocacy organizations, but now there's one central collaborative network that connects patients, physicians, researchers around the world through this really unified approach. We published the first diagnostic criteria a few years ago, published the first predicted biomarker, so lab test you can do to get an idea for whether someone's likely to respond to one drug versus another drug. We built the first registry in biobank. We published the first treatment guidelines a couple years ago. We've made progress, but there are many questions that still remain. Thankfully, there is one FDA-approved drug, siltuximab, that targets interleukin-6, that thing that Kazuo Yoshizaki discovered many years ago. So thankfully, there's a drug that is approved for Castleman disease. And thankfully, now there's one more drug in development, and that's sirolimus. So lesson five that I want to highlight is that it really takes an army. If this was me working on my own, we would have made about 1/1000th of a percentage of the progress. But thankfully, we've had an incredible team. And so next thing I wanted to highlight is if we really wanted to turn the tide against Castleman disease, we needed to expand our effort to include more than just those directly affected by it. More people needed to learn about it so it wouldn't continue to be one of the most deadly, most common diseases that most people have never heard of. And I'm hoping that all of you that have called in this evening will be a part of this army that will help us in the fight to raise awareness and to take on Castleman disease. And that's another reason why I wrote Chasing My Cure, is to raise awareness for the fight against Castleman's. This is slide has a number of images and also headlines from when Chasing My Cure came out in September that's helped to raise awareness about Castleman disease all over the world. The search term Castleman disease came up on Google, or it was searched more times in the months following the book coming out than ever before in the history of Google. So we're raising awareness, but we hope you'll be part of this fight to help us to continue to raise awareness all over the world for Castleman disease. As we turn our focus beyond Castleman disease to think about all the other diseases out there, we can't help but think about the fact that there are 10,000 human diseases, and that there are about 1,500 drugs that are approved for about 1/4 of all diseases. So we have FDA-approved drugs that treat about 1/4 of all human diseases. But for 3/4 of diseases, we don't have anything that's approved to treat them. And so something that we've been big proponents of is this concept of finding old drugs that could be used in new ways. And so the cartoon I'm showing here is of an old dog reading a book about new tricks. So what sort of old drugs could we take and reuse them in new ways? An old dog learning new tricks. But importantly, we also want to spread awareness about the fact that we shouldn't just be reinventing the wheel when we do research. We need to learn from one another. So it's not just within disease groups, but it's across disease groups. And that's why the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network has been partnering with the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative for the last year and a half to try to take steps that we've taken against Castleman disease, this collaborative network approach, and to try to scale it to other rare diseases so that we don't have to continue to reinvent the wheel. And more recently, our group has begun to repurpose our own effort in the fight against COVID-19. So we're repurposing our approach, which is to search for drugs already FDA approved that could help patients today, repurposing our army, which is a number of volunteers who all came together to say that they wanted to help, and then also trying to repurpose existing drugs. As I mentioned, there are 1,500 drugs already FDA approved. How many of those already have activity against a disease that we just don't know about, like COVID-19? So our first goal was to extract data on all drugs given to all published cases of COVID-19. We enlisted a team of 31 volunteers that over the course of 12 days reviewed through 2,467 papers. It was an incredible amount of work that went into that. That group extracted data on 9,187 COVID-19 patients. So the first 9,000 published cases of COVID-19. And from that analysis, identified 124 different drugs that had already been given to COVID-19 patients. So as you can see, doctors all over the world are trying drugs on COVID-19 patients, but unfortunately, those data are being lost because they're being published in papers and you have to find the drug one by one. So we tried to pull all this together into one place to say, these are the 124 drugs that have been tried. We place all the data into a centralized open source database so anyone can access the data. And right now our analyses are underway to try to get an idea for which of these drugs have more activity than other drugs. Another goal and another project we're working on is mapping out the immune response to COVID-19 to identify new candidate drugs that we could go after beyond what's currently being done. So on this last slide, I just wanted to recap with a few of the lessons that I highlighted tonight. The first of which is that we are all in overtime. I can hear the clock ticking because I've had my last rights read to me and I've relapsed multiple times. But I think COVID-19 has reminded us just how precious life is and how we really are all in overtime and really do need to make the most of every moment. And to not feel overwhelmed by that, but to really feel liberated to spend our time with the people that we love doing the things that we want to do. The next is this concept of think it, do it. So as I said earlier, on my deathbed, I didn't regret anything that I had done. I regretted the things that I had not done. And I hope that you all will, if you think of something, that you'll do it, turn it into action. The third is for the gentlemen listening into this call. I hope that you're never confused as a pregnant woman. But if you are, I hope you can find some humor in that and in life's challenges. For the women on the call, I hope that you're never confused as your father's pregnant wife. But again, I hope you can find some humor in that if that ever does happen. I think in the midst of these really tough times, we have to find things to laugh about. I'm going to force myself to laugh about all of the technical difficulties that we had tonight with this webinar to make it work. Because I think that if you don't laugh, then you cry sometimes. The fourth is that we need to turn our hope into action. That if we're hoping for something, if we're praying for something, if we're wishing for something, those are the things that need to guide our action. For COVID-19, that might be practicing social distancing, or it might be helping to review through articles, or it might be donating towards research. But really, it's about saying, if I'm hoping for something, I should take action to try to get that which I'm hoping for to become a reality. And the fifth is that it really does take an army and that we really do all need to work together, because for these really big challenges, none of us can do it alone. I've included some links on the screen, the first to Chasing My Cure, so you can learn about the journey, about my book, Chasing My Cure. The link through this webinar lists the Indie Books website, which actually has Chasing My Cure on back order, which is wonderful because that means that people are purchasing copies of Chasing My Cure. But I've also included a link here, a short link to the Amazon page, so that you can get it in short order if you'd like to get Chasing My Cure more quickly. Of course, it's available on hardcover, ebook, audiobook. I also wanted to highlight the link to the CDCN and an opportunity for you to donate. You can support the work we're doing for Castleman disease, the work we're doing to better understand cytokine storms more generally, and also the work we're doing to try to spread our approach of repurposing to many, many more diseases. And I've included a few handles and hashtags below that I hope you'll help to share. So it is exactly 30 minutes in, and I think we have a little bit of time for some questions and answers. So I'm going to stop sharing the screen. And thank you guys all so much for your patience tonight and also for joining in. Great. So now I'm going to take a look at the questions. So if you have a question, feel free to go ahead and post it or put it into the chat below. Let's start with question number one. Do you think that there's any significance to children being largely unaffected by COVID-19 in terms of potential cure or prevention? This is a really, really good question and something that my colleagues and I and many others have been thinking about quite a bit. I think that my belief as to why children are not getting sick the way that adults are is that COVID-19 seems to have an almost individualized effect on individual patients' immune system. And what I mean by that is that it's unlikely that there's going to be one drug that's going to treat everyone with COVID-19, because in some patients, they get sick with COVID-19 and they actually never even get sick. They get infected but never sick, whereas other patients will have this hyperimmune response where they end up in the ICU looking like a Castleman disease patient. And what it seems to be is that it's not dependent on the virus. It's really dependent on the host, so our response to the virus. And so what I believe this is signaling is that children have a maybe more calibrated immune response, where it's an appropriate immune response. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. I was chatting with my wife and my daughter, Amelia, reminded me this weekend of this, the kind of the Goldilocks phenomenon, where the immune response to COVID-19, it can't be too weak. It can't be too cold. And it also can't be too hot. And so what you need is this really well-calibrated response to COVID-19. It seems that kids maybe are able to have that sort of a calibrated response, but it seems that adults with our immune systems are potentially having either too aggressive or too weak of a response against COVID-19, both of which are deadly. So another question. Hi there, Dr. David. Has your team come close to any kind of a vaccine to beat this virus? We have not. We are not involved in any vaccine development. What we are involved in is this concept of drug repurposing and looking for drugs that are already FDA approved that could be tested right away. And this is really based on the proof of principle from my own experience, where I was dying in the ICU and we found a drug that was developed 30 years ago, had never been tried for Castleman's, that we began on me. And I'm just one of many examples of people who have taken a drug that was initially developed for one thing and trying it in another condition. And we hope, and there's already reason to believe that COVID-19 may be one of these conditions susceptible to these kinds of drugs. The next question, how has this near-death experience changed my life, aside from actually having a life to live? Yes, I'm very glad that I'm still here. And in what ways has this experience influenced the way that I practice medicine? So my near-death experiences, all five of them, really changed me fundamentally, who I am. They change how I approach life. They change how I live life. When I say that I feel like I'm in overtime, I'm not exaggerating to say that I really do feel like I can hear the clock, and that helps me to really focus in on what's most important. It gives me a sense of urgency for the things that I really care about. And so I think probably the number one thing from my experiences is it's made me appreciate every day, but it's also made me say, okay, if time is our most limited resource, then I need to spend it the best ways that I can. And I think that's probably the main way that it's really affected me from a life perspective. From a how I approach and practice medicine, I think that for me, it's made me realize that when it comes to research, we're obviously, everyone is working towards solutions in as short of a term as possible. But I think that it's given me an extra urgency that I don't think I necessarily would have had otherwise, to realize that it's not just about finding the solution. It's about finding the solution as fast as possible in an appropriate way. You don't want to move too quickly where you make missteps, you also don't want to wait 100 years for these solutions. So I think that it's given me a sense of urgency that I don't think that I would have had otherwise. What do you think of the comment in today's times by the doctor running the remdesivir trial? There's nothing compassionate about compassionate use. You're treating emotion. So I really disagree with that sort of a comment about compassionate use. I think that there are certain scenarios where compassionate use is appropriate, and that's where a drug that's not yet FDA approved is given to patients who maybe could benefit from it. And I think that there are examples where compassionate use is very important, where you do give these patients access to drug that would not otherwise have gotten access to it. I think that what this doctor is getting to about you were treating emotion is getting to the fact that for most drugs that are not yet FDA approved, they will not be FDA approved. If they're not yet approved, there's actually a higher likelihood that they will not get approved because they're not safe enough, they're not effective enough. And so as a result, that means that in many of these cases, these drugs are actually not going to be the solution that we all hope for. That's why I'm such a big proponent of already FDA approved drugs that you can use and repurpose, because you know that they already were effective enough to be able to get approval. You know that they were safe enough to get approval. And so that's why I think that off-label use repurposing is so important. The next question, is there any role for AI in the search for old drugs that might be effective in orphan diseases or in other aspects of your team's research? Yes, absolutely. Artificial intelligence is so critical for understanding drugs that are likely to be effective. But what's really important is that once you use an algorithm to figure out what's likely to be effective, in my opinion and in my experience, you need to follow up that algorithm by actually doing an experiment in human samples to actually say, I'm going to work with the human tissue to confirm what this algorithm has told me. So you get the algorithmic result, you confirm it in human samples, and then when you go on to try the drug in patients, it's really critical to track how the drug does. Because just because it was predicted to work well by an algorithm does not mean that it's going to work well in humans, and it doesn't mean that it's actually going to help the patient. And so I think you have to use AI to predict what you're going to start with, but you need to make sure that you're very systematic along the way in moving towards humans. Next question is, how do you sift through and synthesize the wisdom of the crowd you source insights from? Not all ideas are worth pursuing. Daria, you are absolutely right. So the way our approach when we do crowdsourcing is to say, we want every idea that anyone could ever share. We don't want to censor or tell anyone to not give their idea, because just because we haven't thought about it doesn't mean that it's wrong. But we get every single idea under the sun. And then once we have that long list of ideas, we put together a small group of people who can help to prioritize that list. And so, Daria, that's where you get some ideas that maybe aren't worth pursuing that you can kind of put to the side and help to focus on the most important ideas. And it's really important when you do the prioritization exercise that you include people from all aspects of whatever you're trying to solve, so that you're not just a bunch of scientists or a bunch of doctors or a bunch of patients, but you really benefit from having different types of people in the community. Next question, do you find any repurposed drugs to validate? Do you find the resources to do in vitro testing? So there are a number of repurposed drugs that that we found from this this study. 124 drugs were given. Of those 124 drugs, a handful of them were experimental. So almost 120 are drugs that are already FDA approved. They've been given to patients with COVID-19. I think that the good news is that there wasn't a very clear safety issue or signal to suggest that those drugs were not safe. There certainly is some suggestion that some of those drugs might be effective. And so I do agree it's important to keep doing in vitro testing, which means testing in test tubes. But I think it's also important to follow these patients and to see how these drugs do in patients with COVID-19. And hopefully they can have an impact. You know, we're in the middle of a really scary time and need to take advantage of these drugs and see how they can help patients. The next question, as a child to a parent with an ultra rare disease, how best can we help increase prominence of the condition while we continue to be in crisis mode? So this is really tough. Right now, all of us are rightfully focused on COVID-19. This is the probably the greatest threat to human health, the greatest pandemic that many of us have faced in a really, really long time. As a result, it does require our attention. But you make the great point that there are actually 10,000 other diseases that are currently affecting people. And just because COVID-19 is such a problem doesn't mean that your disease or my disease or your child's disease has just gone away. They've maintained their importance. I think that during this short period of time, I think that COVID-19 is likely going to continue to have and receive the attention that it's been receiving. But I do think that things will quiet down. I think we will get back to a new normal. And when we do get back to a new normal, I think that there are things that we as a medical community and as a patient loved one community need to learn from this COVID experience and say, this was done well and it could be applied to my disease, or this wasn't done well and it should not be applied to my disease. I'm very biased because I'm a huge proponent of drug repurposing, but I do think there are a number of aspects of this COVID-19 fight where we can learn about drug repurposing and ways to make it more efficient. No one ever seemed to really pay me any attention when I was screaming about how important it is that we do drug repurposing for rare diseases. But with COVID-19, there's a lot of attention on drug repurposing. And I think that it's rightfully so. So I think that we as a rare disease community need to learn what's worked, what hasn't worked, what's gotten people's attention, what hasn't gotten people's attention, so that when things quiet down, we can really take advantage of that new information. The next question, has quarantine made it difficult to do my work if I'm at home? And any thoughts on hydroxychloroquine? So the question about has quarantine made it difficult to do my work? Well, you guys all saw that we had a false start tonight with Crowdcast. And for whatever reason, audio video was not functioning on the previous platform. So yes, we're having difficulty with quarantine. As far as hydroxychloroquine, I think there's reason to be hopeful, but I think we do need more data. And so I think we've actually just run out of time. There's a couple more questions on here that I don't think I'm gonna be able to get a chance to get to, but I will try to respond to them in the comments section. And then I have a note that I'm gonna read So please make sure to click on the link to buy the book if you're interested in checking out Chasing My Cure. As I mentioned earlier, you can get it, the hardcover, audiobook, and also the ebook. If it's not available, if it's backordered on one platform, I'm certain it's available on another platform. And thank you guys all so much. Andy, thank you so much for helping to organize this. And thank you everyone for listening in tonight. Have a wonderful night and stay safe.